Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Dennis Markell, author, gaming enthusiast, and now somewhat of an escape room aficionado. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 310 of the podcast with Dennis Markell. I'm excited to get to the episode, but first I have a review on iTunes that I wanted to share. This comes from Patty Ozendier on iTunes. It says, "This is the ultimate podcast for fans of children's literature. Host Matthew Winner gets the most amazing guests on his show, from picture book authors and illustrators to creators of graphic novels, middle grade, and young adult novels, as well as agents, editors, and award winners. Matthew Winner is truly the Johnny Carson of Kidlit. Can I get a my word?" Patty, that's amazing. Oh, my word. You totally get all the my words. My goodness. Listen, I'm going to send Patty a button. All she has to do is send me her mailing address, to here@allthewonders.com. And it goes for you too. I have a bunch of really cool All the Wonders buttons that I'd love to send you. Just write a review, and as thanks, I'll send you a button. All you have to do is go to iTunes and post a comment or rate the podcast, and then email me again at here@allthewonders, H-E-R-E, and just let me know. Include your email or your mailing address in that email, and I'll send a button. So, all right, time for today's awesomeness. Click here to start. Dennis Markell's middle grade debut is all about escape rooms, puzzles, and searching situations for glimpses of truth. The voice Dennis uses to tell the story is the very voice that kept calling me back to read just one more page. Dennis and I hit it off right away, and once we started talking, it was hard to stop. And I think it's one of those conversations that you'd want to hop into as well if you were within earshot. I hope you enjoy this chat. Here's episode number 310 of the podcast with Dennis Markell. Welcome to the podcast, Dennis Markell. I'm glad that at long last we are talking. I feel like we've had a long time coming, and it's good.
It's terrific, and I'm delighted to be here sharing this time with you and your listeners.
Dennis, I gotta say, I've been saving this. I know people that listen know that I often have long conversations with guests before we start recording, and I like that because we get to establish rapport and sort of get a feel for what the conversation is going to be like. And you and I know each other already, but I want to bring something back that I've been withholding from you deliberately because I was excited to share this with you and I didn't want to say it twice. So
you still my beating heart. This is exciting.
I want to level with you and tell you that Click Here to Start, your debut novel, is amazing. I love it. I love that you shared it with me because you knew that I'm a gamer and that it would mean something to me, because it totally does. And I've since shared and shared and shared your book with my readers who are also gamers who I have special relationships with. But I wanted to also tell you that right now I'm listening to the audiobook of Ernest Cline's Armada, and that I've been thinking about you daily as I listen, because I'm like, I'm going to talk to Dennis, and it's a video game book, and I'm so excited. So you've been on my mind, buddy. I'm glad you're here.
That's fantastic. I'm delighted. And yes, as you well know, from the very beginning, when I first started working on this book, I was not on social media. I kind of stayed away because I knew it can kind of drag you into the point where you have absolutely spent the entire day on Twitter, on Facebook, and get no work done. So I was kind of avoiding it. And when I finally got lucky enough to get my wonderful editor and agent, they said, look, you have to pick a social media and get on there. And we would suggest Twitter because that's really where you find librarians and teachers and bloggers, because those are the people who are the most important for a middle grade book. That if you're writing for YA, then Instagram or Facebook, you'll find your fans because they buy your book. But we learn, of course, we middle grade writers, that the people who read your books, meaning the kids, aren't usually the ones who buy it. It's their parents, or it's librarians who push the book on them and recommend it and are excited about it, or their teachers. And so through Twitter, that's how I met a lot of these people. And one of the people who I saw talking a lot was this Matthew Winner guy, who was talking a lot about video games and how he would give talks about how video games can be used in the classroom and how they can be used to teach. And I said, wait a minute, this is exactly the guy. And as you know, I approached you immediately and said, I think you like my book.
Well, I don't get approached super often on Twitter or anywhere, I think, because it's probably intimidating for people. So I commend you. I think it's probably intimidating to be like, hi, near total stranger, I have a book coming out. Would you like to read it?
Well, but in this case, I guess because, as you know, I was fascinated to have this conversation. I've been waiting a long time to talk, because when we I will break the secret and say that, yes, I visited lovely Maryland and approached you and said, can we have maybe a little get together? So you and I did meet face to face.
Over French toast, might I add.
Over French toast, and it's a wonderful diner. I think my son monopolized a lot of the conversation because he and you were talking about games, my 12-year-old. But at the same time...
But I'm a librarian. You know that that's ultimately what's going to happen if I'm around a kid. Exactly. I'm going to ignore the adults in the room and just talk to the kid.
Well... And again, you also spoke to my wonderful wife, Melissa Ewy, who is a author and a children's book illustrator extraordinaire.
Yeah.
So you had many people to speak to, but we had so much fun talking about the friends we had in common and the books we love that we never really talked about how you use gaming in your work.
Right.
And my notions of how games work, I've been thinking a lot about it. Because the ones that I talk about in the book, as you well know, are a very specific kind of game.
Right.
And depending on the kids I talk to, because I have been starting to do more and more school visits, which has been absolutely fantastic. What's happened is that some kids' faces light up because they have played these games, the ones that I talk about in my book. And other ones are more used to playing the games that I think you use when you talk about gaming.
Maybe even different. Let's break this down in how we sort of came up through gaming, in you writing a book and me writing a book too, only for on the professional side. But
right.
First, before we do that, why don't I give you a chance to talk about the story, just give your pitch that you've been sharing with what is Click Here to Start, and then I'm going to try not to interrupt you because I'm excited to talk about it too.
Okay. Basically, I mean, the book is a number of things. It's a straight-ahead adventure story about a 12-year-old boy who lives in a kind of a sleepy town right next to Los Angeles, but there's a suburban area called the San Fernando Valley where nothing much really happens, except for the fact that his background enters into this, where his mother is Japanese-American and his father is Jewish, and who works at a college. And this boy, Ted... feels like he's not very good at much, other than the one thing that he's really good at are these particular games, which are escape the room games. which are games where you are locked in a room and you have to put these clues together. And it really needs what we call kind of non-linear thinking, where you're able to take different clues and different elements and put them together and say, well, there's some numbers written on that wall, and if I turn them upside down, they look like a word. And it's that kind of ability that he has to see things in a different way. And he shares this with his mother's uncle, with his great uncle, who was a Japanese American from Hawaii who fought in World War II in this amazing battalion, the 100th Battalion and the 442nd Regimental Unit, which was an all Japanese American unit. And that's the other part of the book, which is that while part of the book is an adventure and you follow Ted because this great uncle passes away and leaves him this kind of junk shop of an apartment with all these puzzles and clues in it, and Ted and his best friend Caleb and a new friend named Isabel, the three of them work together to solve these puzzles and these clues. And the clues come from the historical background of this extraordinary group of young Japanese Americans who fought in World War II that very few young people know about. So it was a very kind of a sneaky way of getting to learn a little bit of history while hopefully having fun solving the puzzles. And because the story is told by Ted, I've tried to write it with a fair amount of humor because I come from a comedy writing background. And I would like to think that the funny part of the story is almost as important as the adventure part. But there is, of course, someone else who is interested in whatever the great uncle, mysterious great uncle, has left for Ted.
Yeah.
And that danger lurks and it raises its head towards the end of the book. And the book becomes more of an adventure at that point. And the stakes get raised.
Okay, here I am jumping in. So sorry, but I'm excited. I'm like jumping excited. So I haven't had a chance to tell you this on record, so here it comes. I love your book. I like obsessively love your book. It's amazing. I really think, especially because you bring up Ted, the voice you use in this is exceptional. It is the voice of me at 12. It is the voice of my students at 12, or 10, or 9 for the people I've been recommending it to. And it moves at such a pace and with such quick references to pop culture and like sci-fi and gaming culture that I felt that it was, for me, and I mean this in highest praise, it was impossible not to compare this book to my favorite adult novel, Ready Player One. So,
well, I think
I bring that up deliberately, right? So I brought up Armada in the beginning. So that was there. And the reason why I say that, though, Dennis, is because I know that a bunch of adults listen to this. It is primarily adults that are listening to this book, to this podcast. But I know that a ton of us love that book, Ready Player One. And here, this is the closest that I've seen come to the tone and the pace and the humor and just the how compelling the story is to that novel. And so that, to pull that off in, you know, continuously for the rate that you do is just amazing. I just loved it.
Keep going. I don't want to stop.
Okay, well, I'm going to keep going. I'm going to read Ted's voice and then I'm going to let you talk, okay? Here's me reading to you, if that's okay. I'm going to go early.
I would love it.
I'm going to go early. I'm going to try really, really hard not to spoil anything in the book because there's a lot in here that happens that I don't want to get to. I'm not going to go past Clark Kent on record talking, despite all of the twists that happen after that. But maybe I'll try to – I might go past that. We'll see. Anyway, so this is chapter 6. The good, the bad, and the junkie. And by now, we are going into Ted's great uncle has passed, and he has the opportunity to go clean out his great uncle's place, knowing that maybe there'll be something cool in there, like what is this? Sounds like some like loot, some weapons or swords or guns or something. He's like, oh yeah, my grandfather was, or my uncle was in the war. Maybe we'll get some like cool weapons.
Which of course they said, you know, parents might not let you keep that because that's, you know, they're like that, unfortunately.
They're like that. So
I should add, I think before, I'm dying to hear you read it, but I do want to point out for those who are listening that the new character who they, he thinks he's going to just do this with his best friend.
Yes.
As a 12-year-old boy, he's kind of ticked off at the fact that all of a sudden his father said, well, you're going to also be joined by my new boss's daughter, because that he wants her to kind of, they've just moved from New York, and he meets this girl. I don't know where you plan to start, but
I won't get to her, but it's good to mention her because we'll be bringing her up in the talk, that there, there really are these three children, yes. Isabel, Ted, and Caleb, that, that are, we need those three to be able to work off of each other through this, despite Ted really being the experienced gamer in escape room games. But to start, just here's the description of Great Uncle Ted's room, their apartment when they walk in. It says, the first thing that hits us is the smell. It's a combination of old newsprint, cooking grease, and some sort of old guy smell. Maybe odor mixed with liquor and cigarettes. But that's nothing compared with the look of the place. Empty bottles are everywhere. There are bags of food on the stained couch. And I don't even want to think what those stains are from. As a matter of fact, there are stains of all sorts of interesting colors on the floor as well, on the part of the floor that's visible anyway. Most of the floor is covered by cartons of old magazines or grimy, broken appliances from about 20 years ago that Great Uncle Ted didn't bother to wash. It's kind of like a museum of gross. Anything too big to pile is stacked against the wall, and the boxes are all balanced precariously, one on top of another. There's barely room to walk. And that's where I'm going to leave it. I'm going to leave that mess of a room that we walk into, knowing that inside this room is really a puzzle that starts the whole story in motion, as it were.
Sure. Well, that's... I was just sitting here thinking, who wrote those words, that masterpiece? That's extraordinary. No, you read it. You read. I feel like I'm one in your class.
Do you have a moment, though, Dennis, when you step back from having written the book, having had time away from it, where I mean, you're not in it, editing it anymore, of course. So are you able to actually experience it as sort of an other?
Yeah, actually, because I do stay away from it. And as you move on to other books or try to write other things, and you're trying to find kind of other voices to write. I will say, again, jumping ahead a little bit, because this is usually the first question, and it's such a great thing to hear. There'll be tweets that will come on Twitter. This just happened when an author who is also with my publisher was just kind of telling an anecdote on Twitter about the boy she babysat for was reading this book by another author at Delacorte, and she then in the next tweet says, it's click here to start, and he's obsessed with this book, which, you know, you can imagine makes me feel fantastic.
Yeah.
And then she says he just wanted, he keeps asking, when is there going to be a sequel, which is the question that comes up again and again and again. And I don't have news, unfortunately. I wish I could say on this podcast, and I have news, but I'll come back on another podcast and we'll talk about that. But I am hoping to write a sequel to it, which would mean that I would have to go back into the Ted's voice and kind of find it again and come. It is as it's your voice, it was my voice to a certain extent. I was able to go back and find my inner 12-year-old self-consciously humorous and self-deprecating at the same time, incredibly oversensitive 12-year-old that Ted can be. And
there's a moment late in the book when we're sort of reminded constantly that Ted is telling the story, and where I'm trying to point out is that Ted is sort of giving Isabel directions for something that she needs to do in her house.
Right.
And he at one point says something like, this phrase exits his mouth, and he's like, and I just said that out loud.
Yes.
Which is, it's those sort of nods to, let's remember that he's a kid just like you, the reader, experiencing this. And it's those moments that you have been able to keep going throughout the book and not lose yourself in telling the story, but continue to remind us that indeed there's a boy behind this voice telling the story that really roots it in a place that allows us to solve these puzzles and to guess alongside the characters in the story.
Would you like a little inside baseball? Because this is kind of a curious thing about how this book evolved.
Yeah.
Which is that the initial premise for the book is when I was talking to my wife, you know, of course, what a walkthrough is. A lot of people might not. When you play a game, almost any video game, and you get stuck, and you feel like, well, there's no answer. I've tried everything that I possibly can try, whether it's a certain level of Mario, or whether it's a game of or Zelda, or whatever.
Final Fantasy was always mine.
But which one?
Final Fantasy. Time to Final break Fantasy. Out the strategy guide.
Right, exactly. Or any of these. I'm a Caleb. I always tell kids I'm not a Ted when I play these Escape the Room games. I get stuck constantly. And I look at this list in my inventory and I say, I have all this stuff and yet nothing is happening. What is going on? And then I have to go to what's called the walkthrough, which, as you well know, is a place online or a place or a book that takes you step by step through everything that you need to do. And all of a sudden you say, oh, how could I not have seen that? That's so obvious. And there's an actual solution, which, again, I think is one of the messages of the book. I try to make that clear, that if you haven't found the solution, it doesn't mean there isn't one. It just means that maybe you have to think a different way. And there's always a solution in some way or other, which is a kind of a nice optimistic way to look at things. So I was talking to my wife, and I think we were trying to decide if we could get our son into a certain school or something, and how was that going to happen, and how was the interview going to go, and, you know, any time in your life when you can't control something. And I just said, I wish there was a walkthrough for life. And I immediately said, oh, what a great idea for a book. And I wrote 100 pages of a different book about a kid who has a computer game of his life. And it was Ted and it was Caleb. And Ted had a crush on a girl and he was trying to get her. And that's the whole book was about a kid in middle school and about how he kind of tries to get her and then the game is helping him kind of clear out the lunchroom so he can sit next to her and talk to her and all that stuff.
Nice.
And it was very much about middle school and a kid navigating middle school with the help of this game. And I showed it to a very, very smart agent named Joanna Volpe. You may know her. She runs New Leaf Agency. Really smart lady. And she had been interested in my stuff. And we had a phone conversation. As it turned out, we weren't a good fit, which is fine. But she did say, you know, it's a great premise. I don't think it's a big enough idea. Mm. And when I tell kids this, what I say is, you know, when someone says something like that, you tend to be very defensive. Or I think one's first tendency is to kind of answer back and say, what do you mean it's not a big enough idea? There are plenty of books about middle school and certainly Diary of a Wimpy Kid. There are all these books that are incredibly successful about middle school. I don't know why you're saying this is not a big enough idea. But of course, you don't say that when you're growing up. What you say is, let me think about that. That's the difference if you're smart. So I said, well, let me think about that. And I actually did think about that. And as happens to many of the authors I'm sure you've talked to on your podcasts, I was in the shower, which is where we get a lot of our best ideas. And I just said, wait a minute. She's not his crush. Isabel is Hermione. And once I said that and realized it's three kids – she's right. It's not that you can't write a good book about middle school, and there are great books written about middle school and navigating that, and they're funny and touching and all that. But the premise of having a computer game about your life is such a big idea that it deserved to be a larger, the stakes could be bigger.
The stakes could be raised.
And so this idea, and I'd always been fascinated, as you probably know from the dedication and from the acknowledgments and from our chats, the man, the great Uncle Ted in the book is based on a real man.
Right.
And the details are from his life. He really was this person and he did have an apartment that looked like that. So I was fascinated by this character, this real life person. And I thought, well, that's perfect. And I had literally in 2 minutes figured out the framework where you say, well, these three kids, he'll inherit this apartment and this will happen and that'll happen. There's got to be a threat and that'll have to end in this way. So I kind of all of a sudden said, now I've got a book. Now I kind of know where I'm going with it and it's going to be an adventure. And then I outlined it and sat down and it took me quite a long time to get it going. But this is what I was going to tell you about when you talk about voice, because I'm so thrilled and delighted when people talk about that and they appreciate that. Because originally I wrote it because the idea was, oh, it's Hermione and Harry and Ron. So I wrote it in what we writers call third person close, the way Harry Potter is written. So it said, Ted slid over in the car next to Isabel. She didn't look very happy about that, or whatever. And it was written in past tense and in third person. Mm. And the entire book was written. I wrote the entire book. The entire draft was written like that. And it was pretty much the book.
It was pretty much. Sorry, I'm jumping on your toes, no? Realizing that you're about to tell me that was pretty much the entire book, that then you rewrote the entire thing to change the tense.
What I was going to say was that, yes, thank goodness for Microsoft Word.
I'm so glad you did. Well,
you wouldn't be reading it if I did, to be honest with you, Matthew, because that I showed the book to a lot of different agents and a lot of different people in the publishing world. And what sometimes you get back is stuff that's not very helpful. What you hear when you show your work, and writers, every writer who's going to listen to this has gotten this from somebody. And now they're emails. They used to be letters, but now they're emails that say, there's so much good stuff here, but I just didn't connect with the characters. I don't know why. I just didn't connect with the book. I didn't connect. And this is this word that you start feeling like a knife in your heart because you hear it so often. And they, as we used to say when I was writing screenplays that weren't getting produced, they kill you with encouragement. There's this, you know, oh, there's so much good here. Oh, you're so talented. I just didn't. Oh, good luck with this, though. Really good luck. I know there's someone out there for this book. And it started getting a little frustrating. And I had the incredible good fortune that my wife, Melissa, works with an editor named Christy Ottaviano, who's a very, very good editor. Mm-hmm. And Christy,
I know that name.
And Christy agreed. She has her own imprint, of course. And Christy agreed to read the book. And she basically said, you know, this isn't a book that I would publish. It's not really for me, but I thought it was terrific and blah, blah, blah. And she said, I wonder if I would connect more with the characters if you wrote it in first person. That's up to you. It's your decision, but I'm just throwing that out there. And I thought, oh boy, that's a lot of work, kind of, sort of. Maybe I'll see what happens. And I wrote the first two chapters, and immediately it was like 100% better.
It clicked. That's great. You found, you. I mean, it's the phrase, the expression when you say you found the voice.
Yeah, exactly. It was the attitude that wasn't, you can't have in a third person narrator unless they are, you know, unless you're talking about the narrator as a character, like a series of unfortunate events,
yeah,
or the secret series. You know, if you're going to write that kind of a book with an arch narrator, then the narrator can have a sense of humor. But if you're writing a Harry Potter type adventure or a 39 Clues type adventure, it's kind of just this person relating a book. So the difference between Ted slid in the car next to Isabel and she didn't look very thrilled about it, and I slide in the car next to Isabel, I can tell immediately that she's not thrilled about it from the expression on her face that makes me furious or whatever it is, but it comes from him.
Yeah.
And you're feeling like, because it's present tense, that you're right there with him. And everything felt right for this book. And I immediately knew that that was the right way to go. And it pushed the book forward in a huge way. It did not immediately pay off that the next agent who read the book said, yes, now you found it. It still took a while, which is a good lesson, again, for people who are possibly listening to this podcast who are trying to sell their books, that that manuscript was read by another dozen agents, I would say, who had lovely things to say about it, but for one reason or another were not able to pull the string and say that they were ready to represent it. So it took finally until I got to Holly Root, my agent at Waxman Level, who just, again, as you said, she got it. And that's all you need is that one agent who gets it. And that was really the start of everything.
So there's this thing that you mentioned that I want to bring up because of how the story started. And I'm so grateful that you shared that piece of how it first, it was sort of this story about
my life as a game that I'm living through this middle school experience. The reason why I bring that up is because one of the coolest and creepiest and perplexing elements of the story that happened right away in your story is that Ted in this server room that he goes to find all these other games, these escape games that he likes to play, a new one appears after going through his grandfather's stuff, right after the chapter that I read. A new game appears on the screen, and it ends up being a game that eerily looks exactly like his great uncle's apartment, and is in fact his great uncle's apartment. And that element that is carried in different ways, carried out throughout your story of who's the game maker, who's behind all of this, is such a fun element, and one that I felt like was something I haven't seen before. And that, as much as I was sort of figuring out the story as I read, that was like the thing that I kept holding out on, going, what is going on in this story? because Ted, and I think it's because of now hearing the way you wrote Ted, that we have a character telling the story that wants to keep stuff from the other characters in this story. And so I don't know, just the way you played around with that was just, it's something that I still think about now, reflecting on having read the book. It's just, that was an element that really, really drew me in fast.
Well, it's interesting. There are two things that I would say about that. The first is I was fortunate enough, incredibly fortunate enough, that Adam Goodwitz, who's I know you are another big fan of, as my son, Adam was a very early supporter of me and said he would love to read the book. And I said, gee, Adam, would you possibly write a blurb for it? And he said, well, I'm about to have a baby. I said, well, you know, okay. If you can get it in by February, that would be great. And if not, don't worry about it. And he read the first two chapters and emailed me a lovely note saying, I really want to blurb this book. And he read it and was wonderfully supportive of it and great, and just said, gave me one note. And again, this is the change from the advanced reader's copy to the final copy of the book, which he said, you have to acknowledge at the end of the book that you don't really tell the reader who's making these games. They can guess. There are all kinds of possibilities. As a matter of fact, my editor, when she first signed me onto the book, took me out to lunch and said, do you know who's making this game? yeah, I do. Actually, I do know who. He said, well, as long as you, I just wanted to know, because it's hard to tell from the end of the book. I said, no, I have a good idea who's doing this. But he said, you have to at least have Ted say something at the end of the book like, gee, I wonder who it is who put those games on my computer, because that's not there. And he said, did I miss that someplace? So I took his note and put that in there. But the other thing that I want to mention about the idea of the game is that the initial aspect of it, which is that this walkthrough was going to be such an important part of the book, and Ted following these instructions, as you may have noticed, we kind of abandoned that very quickly, because that from a kind of a character standpoint, you don't want to have your main character getting all his answers from someplace else. He should be coming up with the answers.
Absolutely.
And so this whole premise that I thought was going to be my brilliant premise of a walkthrough telling you what to do with your life, that doesn't work very well if you have a protagonist who really has to figure this stuff out either for himself or with the help of his friends.
Yeah. Well, and I love even thinking about how to create that for Ted. The idea that your research going into this must have just been playing hours of escape room games, but also then that you, not just playing them, you had to make it. You had to make it and also write it in such a way that, I mean, the first experience that Ted has with the first puzzle in the story is essentially an entertaining read through of a walkthrough. So to be able to write it so that we were still along with Ted and guessing and going like, oh, I can see his skill because he knows to look at something and here's why he knows to look at these clues or to... We're seeing, like, I don't know, there were just ways that you had written that felt to me like... You mentioned earlier in the podcast about knowing that there's sort of different kinds of readers that are picking up this book. Those that have experience with escape rooms and those that don't at all with playing games like that. And so to be able to write it in such a way that says, we know that this kid is skilled at these kind of games because here's sort of the proofs along the way. He's going to sort of nod to you about how I know this answer all along, but it's because this is a common practice in escape rooms, or this is a common red herring in some cases.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And that was precisely what that is doing there. And that was a very, very tricky thing. It took a lot of tries to get it right and working with my editor because it's really hard. I felt it was essential that we see him play a game, as it were, before the inciting incident or whatever we want to call it, before the book actually gets started. We get to see that he is really skilled at this and what those skills are, and teaching people who don't know what these games are what those skills are. It helped that he brought a little bit of attitude to it,
yeah,
and a kind of a certain quality of cockiness.
I was going to say the cockiness that he's just like, oh, I got this. I mean, even when to share, I don't think this is giving it too much away because we're still within that Clark Kent boundary.
Yes. It'll
make sense when people read. But the fact that he essentially solves the entire first room, if we can call it that way, and then sort of allows his friends to figure it out while he already knows the answer, when it plays out in front of him, I think nods to that cockiness too. The let me just act like I don't know what I'm doing here. Let me fumble around with these coins. Let me do whatever, trying to make these wild guesses, even though I already know what's going on. Establishing that early on so that we can have the value of what other people bring to the table when you do get stuck was something that was nice.
Well, I think that also helps to show the character of the other two kids, especially this new girl.
Yeah.
who is, shall we say, obnoxiously perfect in some way.
And could you say it in French? That's the only way you could actually improve
exactly.
on that.
She's, you know, this is where people say, you know, where do these characters come from? And there's a little bit of me in every one of the characters. And because that I did indeed, the school that she went to is kind of based on the school that I went to, a private school. And I was kind of, there was a part of me that is very much that I was kind of the obnoxious person who would quote literary things and then roll my eyes when people wouldn't get them. So, which didn't make me a lot of friends, but at least I could say that she is based on a real character, namely me, at least the obnoxious part. But the other thing I would just kind of talk about just for a second, if it's okay, Matthew, is one of the people whose work I really love when it comes to adventure books is Carl Hiaasen, who, as you know, wrote Hoot and Flush and a whole bunch of other books.
Yes.
And one of the things that he does in his books, I mean, they're all set in Florida and they're all set in a very real environment, but that the kids react in very real ways. One of the things that I found interesting about reading other, because as soon as I decided it was going to be an adventure book, I set myself the task of reading as many of them as I possibly could. I read the first 11 books of the 39 Clues with my son, and I read the, besides the Secret series, which I loved, I also read some of the Alex Rider books.
Yeah, those are good.
And they are great, but, you know, in the first chapter, he's driving a car or he's hanging a window or some adult is shooting a gun at him. And part of what I felt with what I wanted to bring to the table was that when a kid reads a book like those books, when the adventure is such high key, and again, I would say it's called the Brixton Brothers, the one that Mac Barnett.
Mac Barnett, yeah.
That again, those books are very heightened There's a certain level, there's a certain tone to them, which is more like a movie. When kids read those books, they can sit back because they know it's fantasy. That there's nothing in real, no kid in real life gets into a limousine and the librarian points a gun at him and says whatever. I mean, or you know, comes out of a house and the house explodes. I mean, that's a certain style of writing that's incredibly entertaining.
Oh yeah.
But I don't think the kids relate to those kids as actual human beings. They're kind of fun action heroes.
They're characters, if you will. They're not people, they're characters. Yep.
They're characters who you can fantasize about.
Whereas Ted, I mean, I can say this about you. I don't mean to cut you off, but I can say that that's, I think, where I was attracted to these characters was it just felt like I'm going to hand this book to, I'll name him because he's one of my favorites at my school, but my boy Chris, who we talk, how we've been talking now endlessly about the Nintendo Switch and about the different stuff coming out. But my boy Chris, I hand this to him and I know that like Chris is going to see Ted as a person, as an individual, and maybe even as a person that he in some ways wishes was at our school, because sometimes when we are that kind of person, we don't have a lot of other people to relate to.
That precisely is, I mean, it's an interesting thing to set a book. There are a lot of challenges to writing a middle grade that I learned about, and I talk about this sometimes if I'm talking to a room full of adults versus a room full of kids, that when you write a middle grade, all of a sudden you're stuck in, and this might not have occurred to you, but I had to figure out how to get them from one place to another, because that, especially if it's set in a suburban environment, who's going to drive them?
You have to go with the ET solution, ride bikes.
The Stranger Things solution.
The Stranger Things. Oh, I was going to go there. Ooh.
Oh, good. We'll talk about that. But that show gives me a lot of, I felt very inspired by that, because I felt the kids, even though they were from 30 or 40 years ago, felt very much like the kids that I write. And again, that was their reality. In fact, they feel real, which is a very Spielberg kind of a thing.
Yes.
Is something that I really, I never occurred to me that that's one of my influences. But definitely the idea was that I wanted kids to feel like I could be friends with these kids, and that these kids, I could see myself, this is how I would react in that situation, which is why, as you probably know, and again, I don't want to give things away, but the book does take a darker turn towards the end, and there is a real threat. And I waited quite a long time to bring that threat into the book. And when I brought it in, even though it's far less than in a lot of adventure books, it felt a lot more real to kids.
It did. For me, it was, I think because I'm a reader, I think that I just knew that this has to get bad. Something about this has to get bad. It can't just be puzzles. Something has to be, maybe just with the idea of raising stakes, something has to be like semi-life threatening, because that's what happens. Even if we're 12, there are things that feel life threatening that maybe as an adult I can see it and go, that wasn't really life threatening. But as a kid, from my perspective, it might feel that bad. And there are certainly stakes raised in this book that feel dangerous. And because the kids are so real, I think that when I read it, I felt protective of your characters, because as an adult reading it, I felt like I was reading my kids. You know, weirdly, as we're adults reading, I'm both reading it as an adult and as a child, which is a beautiful gift. But I have then that shared experience of, I want to protect these kids, and in some way, I want to protect myself.
Yeah, well, I think that was an element. My editor, Kate Sullivan at Delacorte, who's a fantastic editor, it's one of the few places where I wouldn't say we butted heads, but we had to kind of have a back and forth and some horse trading, because she was very, very wary of any kind of sense of putting these kids in danger, and because of the reality of the environment that they were in, that if they were in an environment like, I never remember the name of this book, but the Mr. Benedict Society.
The Mysterious Benedict Society, yeah.
You know, which is a very, that book is really, has some pretty creepy things about mind, you know, washing kids' brains and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
And it gets, I mean, as does Willy Wonka, if we're going to be honest.
But it
I mean,
doesn't feel like it's the town that I live in. Trenton Lee exactly. Stewart's world feels, there's something other about it. Like with Willy Wonka, that it just feels like, yeah, but a school like this couldn't really exist. It feels like a supervillain having, you know, a place along the side of a mountain or something, a layer along the side of a mountain.
It's a heightened sense.
Yeah.
As opposed to a sense of the everyday. And which, again, I mean, just to throw two people into the mix with a clunk, because I've already talked about Spielberg. And again, I didn't even do this deliberately. It was later that I realized he sets a lot of his movies, his mystical movies like E.T. and stuff, his fantastical movies in the San Fernando Valley, because he grew up there, first of all, I think. He spent part of his time, his life there. But you set a fantastical, mystical adventure in a very mundane place.
Yes.
As opposed to in a fantastical place, because then it becomes kind of, well, it's an everyday experience to have wonderful things happen as opposed to a day-to-day place where kids go to school or have a summer vacation where no one else is around and they're bored. And so these are things that kids can really relate to, I think. And the other thing is Hitchcock talks about that, about that when something scary happens in the everyday world, it's much more frightening because that we can relate to it and say, how would I feel if I was put in that situation, which is exactly what I want the kids to feel. And as you said, that's one of the things that kept me going, because as a writer, I think different writers have different ways of telling their stories. Obviously, that's a pretty obvious thing to say, but by which I mean some writers are more interested in the internal journey, interior journey of their character. How am I going to deal with disappointment, or how am I going to deal with how as a character? How do I, when you're reading the book, is this person going to survive this personal loss or this friendship not going the way they want it to, or whatever it is? And those things are incredibly important to kids as well, and we should be writing about that, and they should help and learn about that. And other fantasy writers will spend page after page writing a backstory or a history or creating a world for their characters to live in that the kids can be very, you know, patient or impatient with. Personally, when I read Tolkien with my son, as much as I loved it, the fourth or fifth time that they were walking through a forest and he's describing every single tree and the lake and the this and the that, I started saying, when's the next thing going to happen? So as a writer, when I write, I'm always saying, what happens next?
Okay, so Dennis, the all of this going into it, your childhood growing up, your interest in Spielberg, your all of this, I feel like, first off, I feel like you and I are like twins. We're like brothers from another mother, which is exciting to me. And it feels to me like, and I think this is something I've said to you in person, but it feels to me like, I haven't said this to you in person. I wasn't a reader, a middle grade reader growing up. I didn't transition from picture books to anything. Once I was an independent reader, I kind of like stopped reading because my parents weren't reading with me anymore. So once I became independent, I didn't read anymore. But I say that because I know my students are having experiences where they find authors that are authors for them. And why I bring that up, knowing now I'm sure you know where I'm going with this, is that I feel like you as a person and you as an author, I feel like, oh, this is an author for me who like gets me and gets my experience, which is I'm realizing is an underserved, I think, population of people. Those people that grew up on video games, those people, my kids now that have great skill at something, but there's a question of how does that great skill apply to life?
Right. That's precisely, I think, one of the issues that haunts Ted. I'm bringing this up to say that I have a sister who is high achieving. She's a doctor when she was in school. She's not as, our age difference is not the same as Lila and Ted, but she was an extraordinary world beater, and there I was, and I was much more like Ted. My basic feeling was, well, I'll do what I can, but I'm not going to do the best I can because then I'm not never going to be as good as she is.
Mm.
And maybe my little revenge in the book is having his uncle say to him, you know, you're smarter than she is. Although I'm not smarter than my sister. I have to say that because she may listen to this podcast, but no, it's true though. So the underachieving part of Ted is something that's very much a part of my childhood and my sense of kind of like, well, I'm not going to try my best or if I'm good at anything, it's the one thing that most people don't value. So
right.
I think that is something that kids, that the notion that it's why again, why I do feel this connection with you, because that your particular, I'm going to throw this word out and embarrass you, but your particular genius, if I could say that, is the notion of taking something that much of society doesn't value, which is to say gaming, which they see as instant gratification or something easy. And that, although I haven't read your book and I hope to, or listen to your lecture about this, that the notion that it's an amazing tool that educators can use,
yeah,
and that people can use to reach kids and can help them understand that the tools they're using when they play games, and they're not just playing them, when they master games, is something that they can apply to other things in their life as well.
Absolutely. It's the reason why I was drawn to write a book, to be specific for people that are curious, because the book's out of date by now anyway. But we wrote a book, I co-authored a book called Teach Math with the Wii. And the idea was that at the time, this was the top-selling console, and it was in millions of houses. And so why do you send parents home from parent-teacher conferences saying, okay, here are the questions that you should ask your reader when they're reading to help them with their comprehension? You ask them, like, what happened in the chapter that you read today, and does it relate to any other books that you've had, and how does it make you feel? Really great questions to make them think about what they're reading, but we're not having those conversations with video games. Why are we as parents being so passive about video games when there's incredible learning going on in them? And more importantly, that's where our students, or many, many of our students, are interested. So you learn the language of video games, and suddenly you learn the language of our students today. And that's, to me, invaluable. So to know that, like, I was going through all of that learning, all of that exploring, while I'm sure you were, at minimum, toiling at the idea of what Ted's story would be, and then ultimately working it to where it became, is something that I feel like is quite serendipitous that we're on this path together.
Well, the more I thought about it, and again, don't forget I have a 12-year-old, so I've watched this firsthand, and this is a boy who reads well and reads well above his level. I hate to use words like level, but I mean, certainly he's able to read very complex books. I was very amused when he finally read this book, which was then called The Game of Ted before it became Click Here to Start. And he devoured it in a day. And my wife was like, well, I think you skimmed this book, Jamie. I don't think you really read it. And he said, well, as a matter of fact, there's a typo on page 15 and there's one on page 4. He read everything. He's an extraordinary reader. And yet it's very hard to get him to sit down to focus on reading because they have all these different distractions that I didn't have, certainly growing up, as much as he did. And, you know, so it's easy to devalue the experiences that they're having when they play video games. And what I was thinking when I was thinking about our talk and talking to you about this stuff, because I do feel like we're kindred spirits in this way, that one of the things that I hate to hear is the phrase instant gratification, which I think applies to games on their phones, the apps, those Candy Crush type things, when it's mindless, really. But even a game like Mario, you don't get instant gratification. You fail. You fail over and over again. And then you learn how to do it. As much as it's about, you could say, hand-eye coordination and reflexes and all that, I think it's also about learning that you have to keep at something and eventually you get it right.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's an extraordinary lesson for kids to learn and to apply to all kinds of things. And in a, whether it has to do with solving an escape the room game, which uses a different kind of logic, or a game where you have to figure out exactly the right combination of keys to press before you're going to get it right, you never get it right the first time. And as I was talking to my son about this, because he's at an age where they're actually starting to write their own games, and we were talking about the brilliance of Nintendo and the fact that one of the challenges when you play different games is that if a game is too difficult, it's just too gets boring because you're never going to beat it. And, right. and so you're just so frustrated. And if a game is too easy. So the brilliance of Nintendo was the ability to create levels that challenged you and kept challenging you. But there was always the sense that if I keep at this, I will eventually master it.
Right. And ultimately that you are mastering things along the way.
Right. And as you say, it's, I think that then you have a sense of accomplishment.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that I think is so that I did try to bring into this book is the notion, you know, that there's always a solution, as Isabel says, that only for death is there no solution, and which is a rather morbid way of saying it because it's Italian, but it's a more positive way of saying that everything else, that you have to find a new way of looking at it. And I think that's something that we all can remember, especially these days, but that's a whole other conversation.
Well, I think there's no better place to end, Dennis, our conversation for now, knowing that we'll pick it up, I'm sure, another time. Probably much, much longer off air another time, because there's just so much. And I don't know that you and I will just have to start our own podcast and nerd out about video games. It'll just be a separate thing. But I want to give you a chance to end with a last word directly to your readers. So this is the question I've been posing to others. I'm going to see a library full of children tomorrow morning. So Dennis, what message would you like for me to bring to them from you?
Well, Matthew, if we had this conversation a month ago, I probably would have said something like, you know, books are magical things that can take you to new places and something along those lines. And, you know, I don't want to get too political, but I think this podcast, you know, might be listened to, who knows, other months, other years from now. And I think it's important to put it into a context that we're going through a time in the country right now, when a lot of people are anxious and scared, and grown-ups are saying a lot of awful things about people who look different from them or worship differently or come from a different country. And I think you see it and I see it that sadly children are sometimes imitating this. We've heard about this all over the country, and even in New York right here, even in Brooklyn, a couple of blocks from my house, this has happened. So this is a very troubling thing to see. And it's why it's so essential, I think, now more than ever, for not just for authors, but for librarians and teachers and your parents, that kids have to be reminded that books are a powerful weapon against hatred and prejudice. It's through reading books that you can meet people who are not like you and can see the world through their eyes and maybe understand them instead of fearing them. There's a book that I know you admire, Matthew, and that I admire as well, A Last Stop on Market Street, by Matt DeLaPena and Christian Robinson. And I think that there are some kids for whom this book is incredibly important because it's the first time they might see themselves, someone like themselves, and their experiences reflected in a book. But for a lot of other kids, for so many others, it's a chance to understand that they may lead different lives from the boy in the book, but they still share so much with him and can see him as a person with the same hopes and dreams that they have. So as you know, and click here to start, one of the elements of the book is this extraordinary story of these Japanese-American young men who were citizens who fought for this country. They fought so bravely and even died for a country that showed so much hatred for their people, locking up family members in camps. And I was fascinated by this. And I thought, why would you fight for this country? And I read a bunch of oral histories of guys who fought and would talk about why they went. And I was lucky enough to go with Melissa, who my wife, who is from Hawaii. Her family is from Hawaii. And we met when we were over there, many, many people of Japanese American extraction, and almost all of them had an uncle or a father, if they were the older generation, who fought in the war in this regiment. And the fantastic narrator of the audiobook of Click Here to Start, Greg Watanabe, we were conversing on the internet, and he has an uncle who fought in that war. And it's a very big part of the Japanese American experience. And I think the reason why they fought, I mean, the reason why this they were able to do this, the common thread was they were fighting to prove they were as American as everyone else, that they were as patriotic and willing to give their lives, not for the America they were living in, but for the idea of what America is. And I'd be very surprised to find out that that's not why today Muslim Americans fight in the American army and the armed forces for the very same reason. And it's important to remember that. And I guess that's the message I would love for your kids to hear, is that we may be different and we may come from different places, but we are all Americans, and reading books can help us to understand how we are all connected.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with books that they'll love. And the Best Book Ever This Week podcast, hosted by me, with book reviews about all sorts of amazing books. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referred to. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment at allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing this podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Molly Bang joins me to talk about the 25th anniversary of Picture This, How Pictures Work, a resource she created about visual literacy that's now been adapted and used all over the world. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.